back broadcasting and with our three colleagues on video already. So after lunch, let's resume our meeting. Now going for agenda paper 6 on identifying the interest rate or return rate.
Okay, thank you, Amaro. Welcome back, everybody. We're now on agenda paper number 6, identifying the interest rate or return rate. This is really looking again for information from you about where we have this time gap, time lag between the transaction or event that triggers the rate adjustment itself and the time that adjustment flows through into the bills to customers. We're interested to know whether the company is compensated for that time lag, or if it's a regulatory obligation, is the company charged for the delay before the for the acceleration of the amounts billed to customers? And if so, what are the factors that the regulator takes into account in building the rate, whether it's an interest rate or a return rate, that's used then for those future cash flows associated with the amounts that are being billed? Perhaps it would help to just realise that one of the reasons we've only had one session with the board discussing measurement. We discussed only one particular type of regulatory asset there, which was one where costs had been incurred carrying out an activity, but recovering all of the costs in the 1 year would have caused too big a spike in the rate. So there was then we used a 4 year period over which the remaining costs that were not recovered in the first year would be pulled through. From what I've heard this morning, 4 years might be a little bit long, but it's within reasonable boundaries. But some of the questions there were, a lot of the board members were interested in, well, what is the makeup of that rate? Is it just trying to capture the time value of money, or is it risk adjusted, etc.? So what we'd like to hear from you is information about what you understand that rate consists of.
Let's start with Michelle.
So again, I'm going to take the summary of what I'm seeing in the country, in Canada. And I also found a document that was filed by one of the entities, was filed as an evidence to the regulator to support their view. And they had made themselves a research in the 5 provinces in Canada and 5 or 6 entities in the U.S. about exactly that question, especially what the rate shall be set up. So I would say that the majority, the overwhelming majority, and Richard is the exception, normally the regulator will compensate for the time lag. I understand that in Altaning it's different, but interestingly I found it at call last night that they are compensated. So you are an exception apparently. So they are compensated. They are compensated, I would say, provided it's a cash outflow. If it's not been a cash outflow, they're not going to give you an interest. That's clear. And that will also cover those costs that I've mentioned a bit earlier, the deferred taxes, the cash versus accrual, the deferred taxes, pension, it could be ARO, it could be a number of you don't never have an interest on that, or a return, that's for sure. So now we have agreed that there is a return in most of the cases. Now, what shall be the rate? In Ontario, it's the exception. The regulator has put a document in front of the industry, and they told them that it shall only be an interest component. That's it. No capital. Nothing related to your capital. And when you go across the country, across the U.S. in the document that I've seen, it seems to be the overwhelming majority of the entities will have a cost of capital included in the rates as opposed to only the interest. For the one that include the interest, and I've got some exceptions, I say in Ontario, so the Ontario will say, okay, is your regulatory item a short term? And if it's a short term, it's going to be, I'm going to read you, it's going to be the prescribed interest rate, which is tied to the banker's acceptance rate as published by the the Bank of Canada's website plus a spread of 25 basis points. Very, very clear. If it's a longer one, they will be the FTSE, TMX, Canada, blah, 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 no, related to the terms. So they're trying to link, if it's a longer one, they give you a bit more than if it's a short one. But this is the exception in Ontario. Otherwise, everybody else seems to be following the rate of return. There's a few, again, exceptions I've seen in the U.S. and also in other provinces in Canada, but that's, I believe, my research that I've done over the past couple of weeks.
Can I just check, these are for the regulatory assets. Do you have information if it's a regulatory liability?
Same rate. There's another question I didn't mention here. One of your questions is that the rate, for example, in Ontario, the rate is fixed for 3 months. And after 3 months, it's revised. So the regulator put on their website what's the rate at the end of each quarter, and that's the rate that you shall use for your regulatory assets and liabilities. Some other provinces, the rate will be updated once a year, but in Ontario, it's every quarter.
Yeah. Thank you for the research. Before turning to Daryl and his question, since we have a regulator here, would you like to weigh in terms of how do you consider this when you are assessing the annual review?
Basically, we did some research to look at a lot of the rate cases that we had. Now, the overwhelming case has been the overall rate of return. However, there have been some specific regulatory assets that have been capitalized at the debt cost, but that's been on a very, very limited basis. And I did some research over 150 cases, and that seemed to be predominant overall rate of return.
No comments so far. Darryl?
It's a question that maybe goes along with this discussion then. So do regulators in jurisdictions that promise rate of return also set targets for what the capitalization of the entity should be? Because, I mean, otherwise it seems like a great play. I get to get the rate of return on the one side, but I can fund it with debt at a lower rate on the other side.
I believe that most of the entities in America will have a deemed structure. And that's what I was reading, what I was doing my research, that's what the comments were in their application saying. If you impose on me, you know, a rate structure, deemed structure, and you're telling me now I have to use only the debt for that, then it's going to be my residency is going to be unbalanced. So you have to give me a different rate then for my rest, or it's going to be triggering a higher risk on my capital, you know, if I'm only, you know, using that rate. So
when you talk rate of return, that is a rate of return that is adjusted for the required capital structure. So let's say my shareholders require a 10% rate of return, I think the number we were talking about earlier, my interest rates are 5%, and I have to hold a 50-50 holding, my rate of return that the regulator would specify would be 7.5%.
Correct.
So it compensates me for the debt, compensates me for the capital.
Correct. And so therefore, when you finance your activities, you know, whether it's your short-term, you know, asset, or whether it's your PP&E, they said, I'm financing it in the same way, so why should I have a different rate for my short-term?
And Daryl, in practice, even if your actual capital structure is different than the 50-50, the regulator will impute and say, well, you really should have 50-50. That's your issue if you're out of whack. But we're going to give you the 7.5, not based necessarily on your actual cap structure.
Yeah, we have had a number of cases where the capital structure was out of whack. Some companies actually had some capital structure with 80% equity. Then we gave a hypothetical capital structure, and usually that does not exceed on a federal basis a 60-40. Now, it could be commonly, it could be a 50-50. We also seen on a few instances where there were some regulatory assets where we did not get a return, like on an ARO or on some specific cases, asset retirement obligation. So those what I would call are the outliers more so than the norm.
I've got two provinces just, where they don't have.
Just to follow up on Michael, and then you come back to the example.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a bit about UK regulation before. It's fundamentally different from kind of cost-based regulation, but just to kind of give a sense of how this, I think the question flows through from two perspectives. So I talked a bit earlier about, you know, over and under recoveries and then collection the following period, and the revenue requirement. That revenue requirement gets an annual inflation allowance attached to it, and that's an observable rate, RPI or CPI, that actually is attached to it. So that is kept current, if you like, from that perspective. Where these questions on rate of return flow through from a UK regulated perspective is that assessing a company's cost of capital, which is based again on a deemed capital structure, is a critical part of the price control. So when the regulator eventually comes up with a revenue requirement, but one of the things that they are doing is looking at the investment the company's made, you know, in its plant, its balance sheet, the operating cost it's going to have, what an efficient level of operating cost is. But it needs to make the company financeable. And therefore, what it will do is provide a revenue requirement and based on all of those things and taking into account that cost of capital structure. So you don't see it explicitly. You can't pull it out anywhere. But it is very, very much part of
the process.
Okay. Understood.
Phil?
Just to follow up on what Michael was saying there, I guess the UK regulated model is a real regulated model. So effectively, we earn a real return on capital, and the regulator compensates the adjustments for the time value of money based on that real return on capital. So if you have 100 units of shortfall when you true it up, say, 3 years later, that 100 units of shortfall will be adjusted for both inflation in terms of, because as Michael said, things are kept constant in prices. So there's an inflation amount. And then on top of that, there is the cost of capital element that the regulator uses, the most recent cost of capital determined at the last price control. And I suppose the only other wrinkle to add to that then is to what extent the regulator grosses that up for tax effect or doesn't gross it up for tax effects.
Okay, thank you. Lily, I'm in doubt if you are raising your hand or... Are you?
I wasn't raising my hand, but I'm not sure about whether the capitalization rate in the regulated rate is consists of a risk premium or just interest and the inflation, but I'm not sure about that.
Okay, thank you. But Dennis, you are raising your hand.
Right, I'm just reacting to paragraph 3 in the paper, and it may be implying that the standard or the process may result in a requirement for the company to evaluate on its own, one, whether an asset or liability should be reflective of interest, and then evaluating how you'd come up with that. In my experience or my head, I'm sort of saying, look, if the regulator, and whether it's in their regulatory agreement or whether it's in the rate order, should, in my experience, clearly lay that out and demonstrate which aspects get an aspect of interest and what that rate would be, usually an authorized rate of return, and that would then sort of take it off the plate of management and, of course, the auditors, and really just not try to introduce something in addition to what probably is at least in play in some of the regulatory regimes.
Excellent. Thank you. Richard?
In Alberta, we have a proceeding that takes place every 3 years or so, and it's called the Generic Cost of Capital Proceeding. And in that, the regulator looks at all of the utilities that it has jurisdiction over, and it sets the percentage of debt and equity that it's going to use for regulatory purposes, regardless of what the actual percentages are. It also sets the rate of return on the equity. At that time, it doesn't set the debt return. The debt return gets fixed based on the individual rate applications, because it's based on the debt and the various debt rates that are applied for each of the companies, because their debt structures, and by that I mean the period of time over which the debt extends, is quite different. So it's difficult to come up with a generic number for the debt side of things. As far as being an outlier, as Michel said already, the regulator in Alberta tends to think of the assets and regulatory assets and liabilities as first of all being relatively short term in nature, and secondly offsetting. And so they tend not to give a return on those particular items. If there is something that a utility is concerned about, they have the ability to go specifically to the regulator and ask for a return on that, which is what we did in the example that I talked about earlier about the project that was terminated. And that may be where ATCO is coming from, that they get specific returns for very specific instances that they've come across, as opposed to getting a general one. Mm-hmm. Because I'd be very surprised if ATCO is being treated any differently from the way we are or any of the other utilities in the province. Okay.
Thank you. Michel?
Yeah, that was one exception. I told you that some others. I've got two provinces where the integrated entity, so it's, the entity is doing generation, transmission, and distribution. There's only one entity in Manitoba and one in New Brunswick. I've got the financial statements of Manitoba Hydro, so that entity, it has no capital. So it's state-owned, very limited equity or retained earnings that are in the company. They allow them to recover their costs and a bit more top-up. In their case, it's less than 10% of equity. In the other case, New Brunswick, it's 5%. So there's no way that the regulator allows them to have a whack, you know, into your rates. It's just your interest, because that's the only thing that you are incurring. You know. But that, again, it's an exception.
Okay. Yes, Mary?
Going back to situations in which the regulatory rate is determined based on a rate of return. So we're in the rate of return scenario. If that rate of return is for something that's going to be recovered over, let's say, a 2 or 3 or 4 year period, and you know, I've learned to scale my expectations down about the return period, does the regulator tend to adjust the allowed rate of return that it determines if general economic circumstances change significantly? So let's say if we were in an environment in which interest rates, whether they went from 8% to 3% or 3% to 8%, would that be applied in effect prospectively by the regulator in terms of new determinations? Or would they also look at determinations that apply to things that have another 2 or 3 or more years to run?
I'm going to look at you first.
The only thing I can say is I haven't experienced it directly. As an analogy, I can point to income tax rates. And when income tax rates change, I know that the regulator does change the return based on the change in the income tax rates. So my thought would be that they would apply the same concept to a prospective interest rate in the future, that if it also changed, that they would change it as well. But I don't know for sure. I'm guessing.
In Ontario, as I said a bit when I started my discussion, I said in Ontario the rate gets adjusted every quarter. Every quarter, if the rate is going down, it's going up.
Well, that's the allowance for kind of short-term time value of money.
Okay, that's a short term. And you have the second rate, which is the for the longer term. It's the same thing. Every quarter,
okay.
It gets
adjusted. So that, yes, and you said that was more an interest only.
Just interest only.
Okay.
And others that I've seen across the country, it could be adjusted on a yearly basis.
But is that for future allowances,
future,
or do they go back and say, and for, okay, so it's prospective? In setting rates for, you know, new entitlements or new...
If I'm correct, at each rate application, you need to renegotiate your rate of return.
No, not in our case. It's fixed for a 3-year period.
But you sure? But when you go back after 2 years, you will renegotiate a new return, right?
That's all of the utilities have to go each 3 years. It's not in the individual rate applications. It's a completely separate proceeding that takes place.
For you, okay.
Yes.
But that refers then, you know, when you get a new rate of return, that applies to everything. It applies prospectively, but applies to
everything, yes.
Not just to new rights or new obligations.
Okay. Correct.
Not updated.
So it's reset, but not on a real-time basis.
Correct. It could be a lag of a year or two.
So could I ask a question which is not directly the question that we asked, but one that's come into my mind during the conversations. But we're talking about the interest rate on the specific regulatory balances, whether they be assets or liability balances. But one or two people have mentioned, and Michael in particular, the revenue requirements and the calculation of the revenue requirement, which typically includes a rate of return to get you to that. So it's not a rate on your regulatory balance, but it's an input to your revenue requirement calculation. And I guess one is it a similar principle that the regulators apply in terms of identifying what that rate of return is that's included in the calculation of the revenue requirement? And secondly, does that apply only to the regulatory asset base, the costs that are treated as capital costs, or can companies also make a margin of profit on their operating costs as well?
You have to remember it works. You only recover your OM&A, your operating and maintenance expenses, on a one-for-one basis. You incur 100, you recover 100. The only place you make money, it's on your rate, North America, it's on your rate base.
On your rate base.
And what's the rate base? It's the PP&E, but it's also the working capital. And in most cases, you will have the same rate of return on your PP&E, your working capital, and also your retro asset and liabilities. So at the end of it, your balance sheet, you know, gets the same rate, generally speaking. There's some exceptions, but that's the simplistic view.
Yeah, and Jane, I think, echoing Michelle, I think generally if you are allowed return on a regulatory asset balance as opposed to rate base, as we said earlier, it is generally aligned with the same return that you're allowed on rate base, mm-hmm. So that there is consistency there.
Yeah.
Phil?
Yeah, just to echo those points, the weighted average cost of capital applied to any adjustments mirrors effectively the regulatory settlement in terms of a revenue requirement build-up.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I appreciate there's not many people here that are not from a North American environment, Pascal being the main person and Michael as well from a UK perspective and Max, but it's a different, because it's not a cost recovery, it is more of a revenue.
It's an explicit part of allowing the company to make a sufficient return to the investment in the network, in effect.
Okay, so that investment in the network is...
So setting a revenue requirement, you need to give the company sufficient return to be able to finance it and invest in great credit rating. So that's why the whole cost of capital piece is part of it. There is, I think, a trailing, I think if I remember correctly, it does trail, or the debt piece does trail an external index, so isn't fixed and final for 8 years. It does trail debt indices, but you can't go to revenue requirement and pull out. That's an interest portion. It is simply part of the overall calculation.
So you know it's a factor, but you can't say dollar for dollar, pound for pound, euro for euro kind of thing.
Well, that would be. I don't think you can. I think once you have the revenue requirement, to use your word, it's a blob.
But can I just double check the inputs in that to get to that blob?
I want to see that in the staff paper, the inputs to the blob.
You should know you guys are going to dare me to do that, Mary. It will be there. The calculation of the revenue requirement, the OPEX just goes through one for one effectively, as long as it's recoverable. But so that the uplift.
To be honest, I'm not sure in terms of that detail. Phil might have a view. When you get the answer to that question, go away and get an answer.
When you get the revenue requirement, it's actually broken, ours is anyway, it's broken down into about a dozen or more different components. So in fact, you can calculate the interest component, and you can calculate the expense component and anything else that's in there. And then when we report back afterwards, we report against each of those line items. So we do have a lot of detail.
Lily?
Yes. I would like to add that our rate regulator, the electricity regulator, compensates also of a component that consists interest rate, which is the interest on the foreign debt, and it consists a risk component because it's a foreign debt to banks, and they from the beginning consists a component of risk for the entity. So we have a compensation for the risk through this mechanism. Eddie, also we have the compensation to the non-risk interest, and also to the inflation, because it's according to the inflation calculated according to the inflation also.
Thank you. Shahu, you have a comment?
Yes, just a clarification. Michelle, maybe. So in the case of the income statement of the utilities company, everything is there same as you assumed when you set a rate, for example, 50% of the tariff, everything is there. Then at the bottom line of income statement, that number is a kind of a cost of equity. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So if we apply the regulatory accounting, the bottom line is cost of equity. So based on the maybe the Lily said, is there a kind of a risk adjustment in the insurance standard there is another source of in the income. There is a kind of a release of risk adjustment. In the case of rate regulated activities, there is no such driver of income, right? Just only cost of equity.
No, if the regulator was going to adjust for that, they would take that into account in the discussions around the generic cost of capital.
Right.
They wouldn't take it into account in the individual utilities application. So it would have been pre-approved in the generic cost of capital when they arrived at the rate of return. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't feel a need to change it again.
Okay. All right.
Can I just pick, Michelle, you've got your card up. Sorry. I thought you were going to ask something else then, because I was directing my question at you, but then generally to the group as well, because you mentioned about some balances would not have a rate of return applied to them, the non-cash balances. And again, I just wanted to double check that was common across the board. And if we're talking about non-cash balances, which I'm not entirely clear what we mean by a non-cash balance. So if that was a bonus or a penalty or something.
But if you have not paid, why should you be compensated?
So if you have a, I guess it would have to be an asset rather than liability, but if, let's say, it's an asset retirement obligation that's capitalized as part of the cost of an asset, that I think would be a non-cash balance asset.
Yeah.
Should you be compensated for the time value of money if you actually haven't suffered the outflow? Is that
correct?
And then them are the ones we see, the biggest ones we see in the United States, where you have the big ARO cleanup, especially around coal plants. They may have had it on the books as a regulatory asset, but it's no cash outlay. We're not going to give you a return to rate base.
Yeah. What about
and pension? It's been a big issue. I've been helping the industry over the past 3 years. The regulator, pension, they were allowing the pension cost to be included in the rates on a cash basis. But the difference between your cash and accrual goes to your regulatory assets, your difference.
Right.
Well, there's no way I'm going to compensate you on that. You have not you know, incurred any cash costs.
Yeah.
And deferred tax assets is another example.
Okay. How about things like the bonuses? Because we mentioned a few times this morning the performance bonus, which you've achieved your or exceeded your performance target in this year, but it's maybe going to be 2 years before that flows through into bills. Would again that be so? Again, you've obviously incurred some costs in terms of getting to your performance, but there isn't that direct link. But is it a case of whatever your bonus is that's announced, that's what you flow through in bills without an adjustment to it? Oh, Phil's put his hand up.
I think Phil
had his hand up.
Phil?
I was just going to confirm, it probably depends on the rate mechanism, really, Jane. I think generally, I think in the water sector, performance rewards are sort of payable in the next price control period, and so they potentially may or may not have a cost of capital uplift for them, dependent on how the regulators set them when setting the performance commitment. So it will be clear, but it could be either or.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments on this particular aspect? Well, if not, well,
I guess the only thing, in the paper there was this talk about day one gains and losses and using a different rate if you were to discount a reg asset, you know, using, I guess, an incremental borrowing rate instead of the weighted average cost of capital that the rate maker maybe is allowing. Just as a preparer, to keep track of that and keep track of all the resulting differences would be extremely complex. I'm not even sure how we would do it. And I'm not sure conceptually, ignoring the practicality of it, conceptually I'm not sure I see, you know, the cost of capital that's allowed is in essence the incremental borrowing rate. So this concept of two different rates seem very foreign to me at least, and also the complexity of trying to keep track of that in the accounting system be very difficult.
Okay. Well, yeah, surely the complexity is one aspect that we are considering when discussing the model. It's very well taken.
But normally when we do acquisition in that sector,
yeah,
and you look at those regulatory assets, and you said, well, the guy can only get 3% regardless of the market, you know, that's the rate that a market participant will expect to get, not whatever the interest rate is in the market, that's the rate. So why should I take a different rate if I can't get more, and everybody knows that's the rate that is the market rate?
Yeah. I mean, if the regulator is approving the amount that you put into the rate case, the intention is that you will get back that amount. So the return that you're getting is supposed to effectively provide for that. I mean, the concept is, I asked for 100, you're getting 100, I will get 100 of value over time, return off and return on, in order to get that.
Yeah. I mean, from what I've heard, it sounds as though that you're all working in environments where the regulator is trying to get to what seems to be a reflective rate of the market, not just the individual entity. So if we were to look at what is a market rate or even an incremental borrowing rate, it sounds though we're going to come back to something
same
quite
as similar. Same as.
Yeah.
Mary, do you have
this? I guess there are two things that I'm trying to square thinking about, you know, Michael, your comments, and also Duane, yours. Is one is I was just walking away from our the discussion that we've had in this section, is saying there it varies significantly across jurisdictions whether the consideration of the time value of money is explicit or implicit. And so this is, you know, going back to other blob theories, you know, you know that you were saying, Michael, in the UK instance, that they're considering, they're aware of the concept of time value, and that is part of what is considered when making a determination of what, let's say, the revenue requirement is, but you aren't told that X amount is the amount for the time value of money. You know, Richard, you said it, you know, you had like 12 factors and it was explicit exactly what the components were. And so I think we've heard about a range of circumstances in terms of, in general, awareness that it is one of the factors considered, but there's quite, you know, that's uniform, and what's varied is the degree of identifiability of what rate the regulator was using. And given that, I guess the rates get reset when, if you're in a return of, you know, a rate of return regulation gets set every several years, and it's as, you know, as a whole, then you know, there, it's a rough approximation of time value. So, the ability to say, let's, you know, go to what the regulator uses may be a lot more challenging, you know, in circumstance, if you're outside of Richard's setting, where you get, you know, very explicit.
Well, no, I would come at it from a completely different way. Yeah. I think, and what we're talking about here are two fundamentally different forms of regulation. Because what Richard's talking about is effectively cost recovery-based regulation, on which you get regular recognition of regulation assets and liabilities related to a whole range of different things. We talk about storm costs, you know, it could be, you know, restructuring costs. It could be a whole range of different things that you end up hanging up on your balance sheet. What I'm talking about is incentive-based regulation, where the regulator is basically saying, look, I'm going to make an assessment of how efficient you are, I'm going to agree some capital outputs, I'm going to add all of that up. You need to be financeable. We're going to have a proper discussion around cost of capital, so it's very, very clear what that cost of capital is, because you can go and appeal on the basis that it's not the right cost of capital. That's going to give me your revenue requirement. That's the revenue you're going to get. So now it's up to you if you want to gain or lose against that, because it's incentive-based. So once that revenue requirement is set for the period, that's what the requirement, that's the revenue requirement is set. The costs are completely at that point, you know, disconnected from it. And, you know, the company will gain or lose against the regulator's estimates, depending on how it performs on costs. But that's the incentive to them.
So you're making the distinction between a cost recovery type regulatory and a more incentive-based in terms of thinking about the relevance of discounting from
your perspective. So I would say it's very relevant where your regulatory assets on the balance sheet and you very clearly have a right of, and not just recover the asset, but return on the asset versus incentive base, where the reality is, you know, the only regulatory asset you're likely to have in your balance sheet is a relatively short-term revenue adjustment relating to over-under recovery or incentives which might have a time lag, say 2 years.
And I mean, I think, you know, personally, and very much a personal view, that we have historically had a lot of practical expedience in our standards when you talk about, you know, Amaro might raise his eyebrow with the experience in jurisdictions with higher levels of inflation, but things that have recovery period of under a year, generally saying let's not, you know, require discounting for the time value of money or accretion, you know, depending. That, you know, that's one thing. Another, though, is especially when you get into longer recovery periods, and, you know, we've heard about, you know, going back to the first one of the early discussions, that if you look at the regulatory adjustments that you might have, there's a chunk that's associated with recovery next year, and there might be another chunk that's associated with something that's over 2 or 3 or, you know, 4 years, and that's a more specific item. I think as we start to get into the longer periods, the, you know, the question then becomes, if you are, And I'm not saying it's measured on a cost basis, but if you're saying this is the entitlement that I've earned as a result of X activity, but it's only going to be recovered over 3 or 4 years period, three or 4 years period, does it make sense to record it on an undiscounted basis? Because normally when you get to a 3 or 4 year recovery period, you know, just step away from rate regulation, you just start thinking about measuring things on a discounted present value basis.
I genuinely think when you get into this, you will find that isn't the case, because regulation has to effectively compensate for that time lag. I think the debate that we've had is, don't invent another interest rate other than the one that the regulator is giving you.
because that's going to create a huge amount of complexity.
And certainly I heard the complexity warning from Duane, but what I'm trying to step back and think about is when you get to things that take more than, let's say, a year to recover, even if the maybe it's even especially if the regulator has built in compensation and somehow that compensation is reflected in your measurement of the regulatory item. What I mean by that is, if I say because I did X this period, I've earned a right to recover Y, and you know Y might include the regulator's allowance for some kind of compensation for deferred recovery.
I don't think ever would. I think that's the point. If you get X, X is the amount that lands up in your balance sheet.
Right, but is X calculated to allow you some compensation for the fact that you aren't going to get it on day one? I agree with you that if they say you get X,
typically not. So I think the answer is typically not. I think the return Michael is talking about is for your current cost. It's not meant to be returned on that extra incentive amount that you're going to get paid 2 years from now.
Correct.
And so if we were to discount it back, you'd have future cash flows that'd be the incentive amount of $1 plus return, and then discount it back at that same rate, you're essentially back at the dollar.
Yes.
Which, I don't know if that's taken a minute.
Yeah, I might need more than a minute, so.
No, I think, I think Michelle raised it. So in purchase accounting in U.S. GAAP, in regulated entities, we assume that if you're buying the plant for a dollar and you're allowed return on top of that plant in the future, then the fair value is the dollar because the return you're going to get is – you know, the fair value is that historical cost because that's what you're going to get return on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's the same thing we're saying about the incentive amount that Michael is going to be booking or his company audit clients will book. That is the amount above and beyond what was already determined. And then you're suggesting, oh, well, there's a time value of money because you don't get paid that for 2 years, even though you earned it today.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're going to allow you return on that on top of what was in the base, you then get this extra incentive plus return on that. Then I think you end up back at that dollar today's.
Right, but I think where I'm coming at it is if you say, you know, what you spent to earn that might be the dollar. You know, that was the cost of the action that you undertook.
In this case, in my example, that was the reward.
Okay.
For hitting some target.
And so if the dollar is the reward for hitting some target, but you're not going to get the dollar for, say, 3 years' time. You know, it's going to take 3 years to collect that dollar. How does the regulator compensate you for the point that you've done the activity, you've earned, you're entitled to a dollar today, but you're not going to get it, and you say it's in the rate of return?
You're going to allow it based on cost of capital for each of the year that assets in your balance sheet.
For that dollar.
Correct.
For that, so I think what I'm hearing is on that dollar they get return on top of that as well.
Yeah.
Over those 3 years.
So you tend to talk about return of, return on. So you get return of the amount together with the return on the amount as long as that amount remains in your balance sheet. Otherwise you haven't turned it into cash.
Moving on to the other side of it. Daryl, I think
I'm terribly nervous at this point in the conversation because I think I'm asking you to clarify something. I hope I'm not confusing everything.
I think I've done that already. So.
I picked up a comment you made there, which I thought was very useful, which was, please don't use a rate other than the rate that the regulator has given us. And I'm assuming what you're saying there is that if I've incurred an expense today and I expect to recover it 2 years in the future, and the regulator has said rate of return, then discount that using the rate of return.
Right.
And if the regulator has said risk-free rate, then use the risk-free rate.
Yes.
If the regulator has said zero, mm-hmm. I will not, in other words, I accept that you've incurred the cost now, I accept that the cash flows. Would you still say then use a zero rate, or do you see that as the exception?
Conceptually, I think you would have to discount.
Okay.
In my terms, that's not recoverable value.
So if I take
that conceptually, but you need to ask the guys how often that actually arises. I think that's, you know, because we can spend, there's always things at the margin.
Hypothetical examples, yeah.
But my hypothetical example, I was talking about the 70 years. It's not been decided yet, but the interveners and the regulator says, okay, you have a $400 million plan that you need to write off. And the intervener says it should be recovered over the same life as the asset, that you get your asset. And we shall not give you a return on it. So I'm going to get a $400 million for 70 years. I don't think they would accept 70 years.
70?
Let's assume they go to 40 years. Okay. I'm going to get $400 million with no return for 40 years.
That ain't worth $400
million. No, exactly. Under US GAAP, we had disallowance as a plant cost in the 90s. And there is a concept of implicit disallowance, which you would discount it back because we're going to give you that plant cost over 30 years, no return. We had to write it back down to a discounted amount. But those were for long-lived assets. To your question, is 3 years, you know, what is that cut off? Is it 3 years? Is it 10 years? Is it one year? To your point.
I'm just trying to adjust expectations.
With Michael, I mean, I would agree conceptually there's logic to that, and it has been done under US GAAP in prior circumstances.
Yeah. Phil?
Just in response to Daryl's question, I guess generally the rate regulator allows the return on capital, particularly where effectively the cash was an entitlement today that hasn't been received. But perhaps one could imagine a scenario, if we talk hypothetical, where perhaps a regulator may set a reward or a penalty, and that reward or penalty could be triggered by performance today and be adjustable in a future price control period. And depending on how the regulator sets that, that could be a nominal amount that isn't subject to the cost of capital, because it isn't a sort of a cash flow that you're entitled to today that you're gone. So in that example, I would sort of go back to what Michael was saying, and you know, I think you've got to focus on what is the regulatory cost of capital. And if that's a nominal amount, then I would discount the regulatory cost of capital for recognising that asset or liability today.
Thank you, Phil.
It did lead then to one additional question. Possibly what Phil's just said kind of highlights that. So would you expect to see that all of the regulatory assets and liabilities that you've identified, given we spoke about them individually, would have the same rate applied to them? Or do you expect that each generation and potentially each type is going to have a different discount rate applied to it?
Our experience, Daryl, is it's based on your cost of capital that you're getting in your normal revenue requirement. There can be one-off differences. We have a pension asset, which means one of our utilities has funded more into the pension plan than we actually have incurred in GAAP cost, and GAAP is the basis for rate making. So what's actually been collected from customers is based on GAAP, but we put even more cash into the plan. And we argued with them we should get a full cost of cap, a full 7.5% in your example. They gave us 5. They said, well, it's kind of your choice. We funded more than the minimum funding. That was your choice. You're probably funding that with debt. It's an operating cost. We'll give you the debt return. So that's just an example where it's kind of one-off, and you can have different answers. In general, though, I think it's more the weighted average cost of capital.
Could I ask, do you think using the cost of capital is conceptually right, or do you think it's easier than anything else? is it something that gives you a reasonable approximation that's close enough and that sort of solves a lot of operational difficulty, or do you think it is the conceptually right approach? And I guess Daryl's example of the 0% regulatory return is kind of the stress test of that, isn't it?
I think if you go back to what the basis, and I'm probably talking about, and these words have been used many times on cost-based regulation, the concept is that you should get back the cost that you prudently incurred.
Phil?
If I can stop there, let that kind of settle. I mean, effectively, the answer to your question, I think, is yes, because the intention of the regulator, and indeed what is sitting within, if you like, the regulatory construct, is that you're entitled to recover the amount that you incurred, and time value of money has to come into that. And therefore, you know, the return has to be part of, effectively, again, implicitly that calculation, because if it's not, then those two things are inconsistent, because you're not getting back the cost you prudently incurred, you're getting more, or you're getting less.
Phil?
Conceptually, I think that is right, Peter. I think I agree with what Michael just said there as well. If you think about it, if a UK utility probably leveraged something like sort of 40% debt, 40% equity, perhaps a little bit higher, and effectively if you go cash flows today, or you get excess cash flows today, then that's impacting your capital structure. So it should be being rewarded at the cost of capital, and that's the regulatory economics of the situation.
Thank you. Mary?
Can I go back to Duane's earlier explanation of how US GAAP has looked at what you called implicit disallowances, in which the US GAAP said yes, or a regulator would say yes, we'll allow it, but we'll make you recover it over, make up a number, 20 years, and we aren't going to give you any time value of money for it. And so you say, okay, you have an implicit disallowance because you have to write that back to reflect the fact that you aren't getting, right, return. What rate conceptually do you think that you discount it at? Do you discount it at just the time value of money or at the return that you're otherwise getting on assets that you're not allowed?
Well, I think going back to the comments, Michael and Phil just made, I think it's the weighted cost of capital. So
there's symmetry, yeah.
But I don't remember exactly how we did it.
Yeah. No, and I wasn't asking what does U.S.
Test, right?
No, yeah. It's not what does U.S. GAAP require.
No.
If you're thinking about that scenario, it's another way of looking at Peter's question.
Because we would get full return on that asset. They're now not giving us that full return.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you would use to discount it back.
Because mm-hmm.
If you're taking a Gammon test, if you think about it slightly differently, I'll call it an implicit disallowance. Let's say you're getting covering everything apart from an asset, and therefore you do an impairment test. You're doing the impairment test, maybe the whole balance sheet, you would use cost of capital.
Yeah, 36 would be.
Because that, to me, implicitly is what you're doing. Whether you're impairment testing an individual asset or you're impairment testing the balance sheet, the cost of capital has to be the right number because that would tie into standard, I think.
And I think the reason we're hesitating is because normally we'd say that the discount rate ought to reflect the characteristics of the particular asset or liability you're looking at. So let's assume for argument's sake it's absolutely certain what the cash flow is going to be in the future. There's no demand risk or any of those other things attached to this particular cash flow, then normally we'd expect to see a risk-free rate there. We wouldn't expect to see one that looks more like a cost of capital, and I think that's our hesitation.
But the flip side of not that, whose characteristic is, this is an asset that's operating in a regulated environment.
Yeah, but if the regulation has removed all the uncertainty, it is, in essence, a risk-free.
Yeah.
And the further complication, if I think about it, is let me go back to Richard's example. If we tie it always to what the regulator allows, then does it make sense? Tim, maybe I'm almost putting you on the spot thinking about a user perspective, but does it make sense if Richard is operating in an environment in which there's explicit determination of what the interest allowance is, the time value? I guess, you were saying it was Ontario that was explicit that it was just the time value of money. Sorry, that's what I was thinking of. Is the limited to the time value of money recoverable on deferred settlement? Does it make sense to have the different discount rates tied to what the regulator allows as opposed to the straight time value of money is or risk adjusted?
Just come back to that risk-free comment. If that was the case you described it, then banks would lend to you on at the risk-free rate, and they won't. I mean, the cost of capital is based on expected lending rate for the credit rating that you have. So just because you've got some certainty of future cash flow doesn't mean that you're
a banker.
What I was going to say, and I agree with you completely on that, I guess the perhaps the comparison of the two rates we should be thinking about is the 5% rate,
when we used the examples earlier, the 5 and the 7.5%. So if a utility in Ontario is only getting 5%, and a utility right next door across the border is getting 7.5% because the one regulator says cost of capital and the other one says funding, but we're saying that actually we're treating those as economically identical, they feel very different. And is it appropriate that we should actually be treating them? And then I think it comes, Duane, and I know you said you don't often see this, but you then take it a step further and say you could actually have those two liabilities or assets existing on the same balance sheet. One being measured at 5%, one being measured at 7.5%, but arguably they're exactly the same. It's the same future cash flow, potentially with the same level of certainty attached to it. But I'm treating one as I'm discounting them completely different rates, and that seems economically hard to justify.
I mean, I think the thing there is, without answering the questions, I think you really need to go away and understand the detailed facts in each case, because I would find I would really struggle to see by drawing a line like that and putting one company one side the other, you would get that kind of difference in exactly the same with all other facts and circumstances being the same. I don't think that would actually any form tie in with what regulation is supposed to do. So I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's like all these things, if we peeled it back, it'd be quite interesting to see if it's not really quite as described as.
Phil?
Just in Daryl's example there, I probably would err towards using the cost of capital. So in the 5 over 7.5%, I think in the situation where you've got the 5%, then effectively I would discount that at the 7.5% cost of capital. And I think that reflects a regulatory judgment, which is causing a gain or loss effectively.
And Phil, would you then be comfortable that that would imply that, for example, the companies in Ontario would recognise an immediate day one loss being the difference in the present value of the number that they're expecting, discounted at the capital cost of capital, but taking into account that they're expecting the, I wouldn't say the risk-free rate, the incremental borrowing rate?
I think sort of probably we'd need to understand the implications and how common this sort of situation is. But for me, it feels like a negotiating position for the regulator that's sort of impacting the overall value position. But I would, from a principal's perspective, be very much towards the cost of capital. And I think if a regulator puts another number, then I think that is effectively a gain or a loss effectively being caused by a regulatory judgment.
Bishop?
A couple of things. The size of the differential that you were talking about, we tend to see that between the US and Canada, but not within Canada. All of the regulators are in constant touch with each other and have regular meetings. Not only that, but when we're in any kind of rate discussion, trying to set a rate, they always look to see what the other provinces are allowing. So although there are differences within Canada, they tend not to be as stark as the differences that you just mentioned. The other thing is, just to reply to something that Michael mentioned earlier, I did go back and look at the incentive-based rate-making decision, which is a 2012 decision of the Alberta regulator. And in there, they do ask for a lot of information to start off with. You have to build up your starting cost number for the first year of your incentive period in exactly the same way as you build it up. It doesn't matter whether it's incentive or cost of service. Now, for incentive, there's a whole bunch of other things. There's inflation factors, there's productivity growth, there's a whole bunch of other things. But they are also all built into that decision. So all of that detail is available. Not only that, but they have to provide all of that detail in an annual report to the regulator. So the points that I was making earlier about that level of information being available, it's true whether it's cost of service or whether it's incentive. It's there.
Thank you. Duane?
Yeah, I don't know if this will be helpful or not, but as I was thinking about this position, or this paper, one touchstone that you might want to keep thinking about is, and it was mentioned earlier, that one of the reasons we talked about at one of our last meetings, the usefulness and the relevance of the financial statements, this net income ends up being an indicator of your future earnings power, the return you're getting on your equity, on your rate base. And so doing this discounting of things, I just would ask you to think about, are we distorting that to such an extent? It's an accounting convention, and I get it, but does it distort the end answer where it becomes less relevant again? Because we're trying to be conceptually pure with present valuing. And I could get my head around, because part of me is like, if you start discounting, I think you're starting to take that equity return and distorting it in the current period and future periods. And while conceptually I get it, anyway, so it's just something to think about as you're going through this.
Look at the air traffic control, where they're not allowed to make profit. It's a not-for-profit. They're only allowed to recover their cost. Now, if we start to change that P&L impact, but that's going to create a loss. But because I'm not allowed to make a loss, I will have to create a new regulatory asset for that that item. Then I will have to discount that. It's going to become a circular, interesting, you know.
Well, rate making, I'm sure they wouldn't do that. But that would cause, you know, I think, Tim, that would cause more complexity in your analysis of these financials compared to not. But, you know, I just think going back to that touchstone where we were talking about the relevance of these numbers is important.
Yeah, I mean, as a general comment, as a commercial lender, I think there's a materiality threshold that we would have to hit here. I couldn't say with a straight face that we're diving into every regulatory nook and cranny when we look at the default risk of a borrower. We do look at stuff, and we are diligent in how we do it. But again, unless it hits a materiality threshold where it's on the radar screen and for a good reason, we're probably not actively looking at it in depth for every little regulatory account and how we discount it back and returns and that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, after all, this is an A-rated portfolio if you're covering power utilities that are regulated in North America. This is not a double B CLEC kind of thing or a high-yield credit where you're really diving into the weeds.
There's an element of this double back into the fact that I think I certainly came in here thinking a lot more about longer-term assets and liabilities. I think one of the things we've established is most of these are very short-term. Does that play into it a little bit, that it turns into cash very quickly, so it doesn't really matter discount rates and things?
Yeah, I think that's certainly helpful, Daryl. I mean, again, when you're looking at deferrals, that's the same kind of analysis you do, which is the shorter the deferral, the better for the lender and the better for the borrower's repayment ability. So I think that's a fair comment.
It's interesting if we put into perspective the transaction which is currently taking place, that you're going to be part of it. In Ontario, there's going to be a regulatory asset that is going to be sold to a trust, and the trust will finance it through the banks, and Tim would be one of those bankers. And that asset is sold by the ISO company, and we talk about $20 to $25 billion, and it's going to be sold at book value and its own return of it, whatever the return will be over the next year, because it's going to be created over the next 10 years that you get your asset. And every year we're going to be selling the part of it, but always at book value, including its own return at that time. So it is no...
Now that one's attracting a great deal of attention. Obviously, a large amount of money. Your ability after the moratorium period to earn that back, to claw that back, at what rate, greater than or equal to the curve, a whole bunch of stuff's going on. Again, these are securities that are going to be sold in the public market, so the rating agencies are involved.
And it seems we're going to get the AAA like on that. Is that correct that I heard or not? No, actually.
Well, anyway. No comment.
It's going to be a very highly ranked.
Good move.
But you know, clearly, we've been on this for a long time, and that was before the legislation was drafted. How the legislation allows us to recover is important. Change in law, how we get to deal with that. Like, this has to be ironclad. Look forward to the rate base of Ontario and our ability to recover it. Otherwise, again, the rating won't be there. Your ability to sell it. et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot going on there.
But here again, here we have two entities, ISO and OPG, and OPG will set up the trust. So ISO will sell that at book value, including its own rate, not at the market rate. The market rate is that. Be sold to OPG, and OPG will go on the market. So it's a transaction happening between two different parties. And there's no time value, no change. You know, that's the fair, that is its fair value. I know, just maybe that time. We talk about here $25 to $30 billion. Mm-hmm. With interest over the 20-year period, it's going to make the asset $60 billion.
And that's constantly putting new assets in, which is what covers the duration.
Yes.
Because you don't have that.
The asset would be building up over the next 10 years, and we'll start only recovering from year 5 over year 30.
It's an unavoidable charge on this particular large category of rate base in Ontario, or at least that's the theory.
That was very good for us to close the session hearing from the user side on how they assess this information. So we had some productivity efficiency gains here, so we are 7 minutes ahead of our coffee break, but I propose